Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, not long ago, we did a show about a woman named Emma Edmonds, who posed as a man back in the Civil War and served as both a soldier and a spy for the Union side. So it turns out there have been a number of deep cover American female spies in history. And here we're not talking about people like Valerie Plame, the CIA agent who was outed during the Bush administration. I think she was more like a handler of spies and an analyst. But I mean, here, women who did the down and dirty work of human intelligence in situations where they would have been tortured and shot if found out, and in some cases were. And there have been several. And we're going to talk about them with my guest today, who is Dr. Vincent Houghton. And he's an historian and the curator at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Vince.
Hey, good to be here.
Okay, if we call you Vince?
Absolutely.
All right, good. And most people have heard of Mata Hari, right? The Dutch exotic dancer who spied for Germany against the French in World War I and was executed under mysterious circumstances. Maybe she wasn't even a spy in the end, but she probably originated the popular mystique of the female spy, as carried on in James Bond movies like Dr. No and From Russia with Love and Goldfinger. But there have been some real-life American counterparts of Mata Hari, and we're going to talk about some of them today. So why don't we just plunge in, Vince? I think maybe let's start kind of chronologically, and I've read a little bit about some of these people, and one was Anna Smith Strong, so why don't you start by just kind of describing what she did and when?
Yeah, well, I want to throw a caveat out in the very beginning. When we're talking about spies from this distance and time, it's difficult to get perfect information about any of these people. So when you're talking about prior to the 20th century, it's hard enough for any historian studying agriculture or studying economics to get good documentation about whatever they're looking at. With intelligence, it makes it even more difficult. So we think we know a pretty decent amount about Anna Strong. We think that she was involved in a spy ring called the Culper Ring, which has now been made famous because of a TV show, several books. The Culper Ring was a spy ring that was run by George Washington, by one of his top lieutenants, a guy named Benjamin Talmadge. And it was a ring made up of people that Talmadge grew up with, spies from his hometown of Setauket, Long Island. Hmm. And these were people that he could completely trust. One of the big issues of, you know, how can you make sure you can trust people that you don't know all that well? Well, Talmadge didn't have that problem. Talmadge rounded up his childhood friends, and one of them was this woman, Anna Strong. And we know a little bit about her. We know a lot about her. We know a little bit about her spying, but it seems like she was integral to this spy ring, this Culper Ring. The operations probably would not have been as successful, or maybe would have failed completely if it wasn't for not only her participation, but her ideas about about being able to move information from New York City, which was the target of the spy ring, back to Washington's headquarters.
The part that intrigued me was that her kind of means of communication, at least in some ways, was to hang laundry on the clothesline in a certain pattern. So it was kind of a semaphore that a counterpart spy from some distance away could see what she was trying to communicate. Is that true?
That's the urban legend. That's the scuttlebutt. The idea, okay, basically, is that Anna Strong was the middle person. She coordinated the information being passed between Abe Woodhull, who was the kind of the guy on the ground who was running this operation, and a man named Caleb Brewster, who was the courier. Caleb Brewster was a whaleboat captain, so he sailed back and forth between Long Island and New York City. And so whenever there was information to be passed along, the story goes that Anna Strong hung up petticoats in a certain way that would signal that there was information to be passed along.
All right, so I see that there's possibly some degree of mythology and maybe, you know, exaggeration and storytelling, especially the further back you go. And obviously, this is clandestine stuff, and they weren't, you know, kind of writing books at the time about what they were doing. So maybe as we get closer, things will be a little better known. But coming forward in time, another one I read about that was interesting, and just kind of briefly, because we'll get into some of the more recent ones in more detail and depth, but Mary Bowser in the Civil War. Tell us about her.
Yeah, here's another great example of where mythology has to be kind of taken apart in order to get to the real story. So Mary Bowser was one of the spies for a southern white woman who ran a very successful spy ring from Richmond during the Civil War, a woman named Elizabeth Van Loo. And Bowser was, at one point, one of the family spies for the Van Loo family. Well, when Elizabeth took over the family after her father died, she freed all of her slaves. But Bowser began a long career working for Van Loo, trying to pick up information on what the Confederacy was doing against the Union, because they still stayed in Richmond. And one of the huge advantages of Mary Bowser is twofold. One, that she was a woman, and so that she was completely underestimated by the military and the political leaders of the Confederacy. But two is because she was African-American, and she was so the double whammy really took advantage of the stupidity and prejudices of the Southern gentlemen, thinking that a woman can't understand all this military stuff, and certainly not a slave who has no education, who is dim-witted, and we can talk directly in front of her and then there'll be no damage done. Well, they didn't realize that Bowser had been educated. Van Loo had sent Bowser to be educated at a Quaker school outside of the South, and by most accounts, she had a photographic memory. So everything that was talked about in front of her, she was able to gather and then bring back to Van Loo, who got it back to the Union Army. Now, where this goes from, we pretty much know that's the case, to we're not 100% sure, is the story that she was actually hired to work inside Jefferson Davis's White House, his Southern White House, and be able to report on everything that was happening inside the home of the Confederacy. So this sounds like it's possible, but we don't have 100% guarantee whether or not that's the case. Really, again, it's scuttlebutt, it's urban legend, but it's certainly possible, because there were people who worked as slaves inside the Jefferson Davis White House, and if one of them happened to be Bowser, this would have been one of the largest coups of intelligence during the Civil War.
And of course, another skill, if all that's true, another skill she would have had would be to be a good actress, because she was actually an intelligent, articulate, you know, well-read, literate woman posing as an illiterate, dumb person. So that's kind of hard to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And
all
and
the
Van
time.
Loo,
never any break in that, right?
And Van Loo, who was her boss, had to be a great actress, too, because she was clearly an abolitionist, but she had to pretend to basically be a crazy woman.
Wow.
So they're like, oh, she's just a crazy woman. We don't worry about her. And then Bowser had to play stupid. Had to play the role of a slave who had no education, had no background, really didn't understand what was going on. Well, at the whole time that she was highly educated and she was really brilliant, but she had to dumb herself down in order not to be caught as a spy.
Wow, I mean, what a personality! And we've never heard of either of these people we talked about. Now, here's one that we have heard of, or a lot of people have, and in fact, it's kind of ironic that it combines two of the traits that we just talked about with these previous two women. There was an African-American exotic dancer named Josephine Baker, who was famous like Isadora Duncan was in France before World War II as a dancer. And in fact, she was, if anything, more famous as an exotic dancer than Isadora Duncan was as a modern dancer, because she was very sexy and she kind of played on the mania for all things African in Western Europe at the time. And she had this, you know, banana skirt that she'd wear and that kind of thing, and really good looking and kind of had a sexual charisma about her. So I think that was mainly what she was, but she also used her entertaining skills to gain access to embassy and ministry parties. And so I think she was recruited by the French to be a spy as well. She was an American woman, but why don't you tell us a little bit about her too?
Yeah, so I think she was renowned as a dancer, but she certainly was a musician as well. And I think that Baker was an accidental spy, actually. She found herself in a position where, because of racism in the 1930s in the United States, because her inability to do what she needed to do here, you know, and be a successful entertainer, she went to France in the 1930s because there's far less racism. You know, it wasn't completely no racism in France, but there's far less racism there than in the United States and certainly in the South in the 1930s, and got caught, essentially, during the German invasion of France. And this was an opportunity that she had of perhaps kind of getting out, because she was world famous at the time. She was somebody that even the Nazis knew who she was, but instead stayed behind and helped aid the French resistance during World War II. She had fallen in love with Paris, she had fallen in love with France, and she felt that she needed to do something to actually stop or to prevent the Nazis from consolidating their power within France. So she used her fame to actually pass messages from the resistance to other resistance groups, but also from the resistance to the Allies. And in many cases, she would be stopped by a Nazi patrol or anything like that, and they would want to search her, and she'd be like, "Don't you know who I am?" And they certainly did. They certainly understood who she was. She was able to kind of say, "You're not going to search me that deeply because I'm Josephine Baker." She was also able to take sheet music, and this is one of the great tradecraft things that she did. Sheet music with musical notes within the bars, and then within the space, the dead space in between the bars of the music, they were able to write in invisible ink and secret writing in between the bars. And so when she was searched, you know, in a very cursory way, she's like, oh, I have your sheet music. This is for my entertaining. When in essence, there were actually written notes in invisible ink that was information being passed from Great Britain and the Allies to the resistance and vice versa.
Well, that's great. Good story. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Vince Houghton, who is a curator and an historian at the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about American spies throughout history who were women. We're going to talk about a couple of British ally spies as well. You know, predominantly American spies who were women who did very brave things, in some cases just, you know, death-defying things. Another one is Virginia Hall, who I think is the Gestapo actually considered her to be the most dangerous of all Allied spies I was reading, and I had never heard of her. I mean, there's examples of people who, except for Josephine Baker, who you've never heard of, and we'll get into some more, you know, during World War II in particular. So let's kind of transition into World War II and talk about Virginia Hall.
Well, you're going to hear a lot more about her, because I think there's a couple of movies in production now.
Oh, really?
About Virginia Hall's life. That's how extraordinary she was. This is a woman who also faced rampant sexism in the United States back in the 1930s. She wanted to be a State Department Foreign Service officer, which is very difficult to do as a woman anyway. Unfortunately for Virginia Hall, she got in a hunting accident in the 1930s, and I say accident, she shot herself in the leg, and because of that, her leg had to be amputated, and that really ended any career that she could possibly have in the State Department. It's unlikely she would have had much of a career anyway because she was a woman at the time, but the State Department used this as an excuse to essentially say, you're done, you're not going to do any kind of work with us. So she went to Europe in the late 1930s to study, like so many people did here in the United States, and got caught up when World War II began. This is before the United States had joined the war, so at first she worked with the British SOE, the Strategic Operations Executive, which was the unit that was tasked by Churchill to set Europe ablaze, to do everything they could to slow down the Nazis, to make their lives miserable until the British and the Allies could mount an actual counteroffensive into Europe. During this time, she was an incredibly effective spy. She was somebody who worked as a conduit for communications between Britain and the resistance movement. Now, being a radio operator, which she was arguably one of the most dangerous things you could possibly do as a resistance officer, because the Germans had a very good track record of hunting down radio operators. They were able to triangulate radio signals and find these operators very, very quickly. So you had to send your message and then get on the move before the Gestapo showed up to try to arrest you, maybe even minutes before the Gestapo showed up.
Wow.
And Hall was able to do this with one leg. Eventually, she got pulled out of France once the Americans joined the war, and she had to actually cross the Pyrenees Mountains that separate France from Spain, limping on one leg across the mountainside. She's pulled out. She eventually moved from the SOE to the OSS, which is the American precursor to the CIA, and then was reinserted into occupied France right before D-Day. By reinserted, she was parachuted into occupied France, again, with one leg.
Oh, my gosh.
Her wooden leg, like, kind of on her back as she came down in the parachute.
Oh, my gosh.
Reestablished communications with the resistance and helped to coordinate resistance operations to work in conjunction with the D-Day invasion.
Yeah, and I think the Germans eventually knew from various sources that a tall woman with an odd accent and a limp was coordinating a lot of stuff and actually running resistance brigade. I mean, she, you know, she was pulling together all kind of people and managing it, really. And so they were like hot on the tail of this woman who would stand out like a sore thumb, but they never caught her. It was amazing.
Yeah, no, the incredible limping lady was able to stay just enough ahead of the Gestapo to prevent them from catching her. And they were on the hunt. Again, she escaped certain situations by minutes.
Wow.
Or she would have been rounded up, and her future would have been pretty horrible if she had been caught by the Germans.
Yeah, tortured and then shot. But, I mean, she was extremely lucky, but extremely resourceful and smart, too. I mean, so, you know, I'm glad they're making one or more movies about her, because some of these people absolutely deserve to be very well known and recognized as heroes in American history.
Yeah, and Hall was the only civilian woman in World War II to be awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, which is the second highest award for the military. Essentially, the Medal of Honor is the only thing higher. And Bill Donovan, who was the head of the OSS, pinned it on her personally. She was certainly revered and celebrated during her time. It's just been, there's been so many decades in between that her name has kind of fallen out of the historical record, at least for the average person.
You know, again, a lot of this stuff was classified at the time, and I think I read that the president wanted to announce her and make her famous, and she said, no, nothing doing. I want to keep working for the CIA, and I don't want you to blow my cover, so give me this award in a little room in private, and I'll take it and put it in a drawer, and that'll be that, you know?
Yeah, she also had a fairly successful career afterwards working for CIA.
Right.
Until she got a little too old and she retired.
Yeah, but I mean, she retired alive. What a life, my gosh.
Yep.
Amazing. So let's switch to someone who is a British agent who was equally brave, didn't live nearly as long, but Violet Szabo, how do you pronounce it?
Szabo,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so she did very similar things to Virginia Hall. She actually worked for the British SOE, the Special Operations Executive. She was very good at this until she got herself in a situation where the Germans were rounding everybody up. They were doing everything they could to try to find all these operatives, and she got caught in a German checkpoint moving from one place to the other when she was working with different resistance movements. This is after D-Day, right? So there's already a full-fledged Allied advance moving into Western Europe. So she was moving from one place to the other with a man inside a car, and they ran into a German roadblock. Some people would have decided to try to run away or talk themselves out of it. Actually, the man that she was with said, "You run. I'm going to fight these guys and give you time to get away." Violet said, "No, nothing doing," and actually stayed with the man and had a full-fledged firefight with the Germans. She took out several Germans before they decided to take off and provide cover. Once she ran away and provided cover, she didn't go away and try to get away. She actually helped the man to get over to where she was also. So they continued this running firefight. Again, straight out of the movies, right? There's firing machine guns back and forth.
Unreal.
With the Germans. And eventually got to the end where she was bleeding. She was exhausted. She couldn't keep going any further.
She had twisted her ankle too, I think, right? She couldn't run anymore.
She basically was in a position where she knew that she was going to do a last stand kind of thing. But what she did was allow the man she was with to escape. Kept firing away, ran out of ammunition. The Germans came and captured her, and even though the man she was with hadn't fully escaped yet, she was able to cover up for him and say that he was far away, so he was able to finally escape.
Wow.
This is when her life got pretty terrible. She was turned over to the Gestapo, who interrogated her. It's not the way the FBI today interrogates somebody. It's not questions and answer. This is full-fledged torture. She was sexually assaulted and tortured more. Eventually, the fear was that the Allies would try to rescue her. So eventually they sent her to a concentration camp. And during that time, they executed her with several other people who had been caught as part of the resistance.
Now we're talking here about, I've seen a picture of her, a beautiful young woman. She was 23 years old at the end.
Yep.
I mean, she started, I don't know, at 21 or something. Something, it's almost inconceivable to think about young Americans, women or men almost, well, particularly women, doing this kind of thing today. I mean, as you say, a run-and-gun kind of, you know, machine gun battle with the greatly outnumbered against German forces who she knew were going to capture and kill her. And I read that when they took, they finally did capture her and dragged her to an officer, he was trying to insinuate himself with her and congratulating on her bravery, offered her a cigarette, and she spat in his face. I mean, this is not a compliant, fearful first person. She was unbelievably brave and bold, you know, so.
Well, I mean, this is a situation where people believed that national sovereignty was at stake, and for most of Europe it was, and certainly Britain felt that they were next.
Yeah.
So everybody from top to bottom in every segment of society was willing to fight and willing to die in order to defeat the Germans. I mean, you can't imagine that perhaps today here in, you know, like the United States, our national sovereignty is not at threat. But you do see it around the world. There are Kurdish women right now who are younger than Violet was when she started fighting that are fighting ISIS right now in the Middle East. And they're doing exactly that. They're carrying assault rifles and getting in running gun battles and trying to kill these people who are threatening their national sovereignty. So extraordinary events bring out extraordinary people, and Violet was certainly one of them.
Well, you know, that concept of the greatest generation, I mean, these are examples of people in that generation, Americans at the time, who were absolutely willing to risk everything fearlessly and go to the absolute limit of their abilities to fight for freedom, right? And
yep,
freedom for
absolutely.
Other people, you know. All right, let's switch back to an American named Betty Pack. Now, she was a different kind of package, but go ahead and describe her.
Yeah, so Betty Pack is kind of the stereotypical spy when you think about women who use their bodies, which is stereotypical but not typical. She kind of falls into the Mata Hari idea, but she's brilliant. She was somebody who understood the assets that she had and how to use them effectively to help the Allies during World War II. She was American-born from Minnesota. She had British citizenship because she had married a British man who gave her British citizenship since he lived over in England. And she worked for the Allies during World War II. She worked for MI6 first and then the OSS. She was willing to take just about any risk to collect information. And she was unbelievably effective. One of the things that made her famous was the infiltration of the Vichy embassy here in Washington, D.C.
Explain what Vichy is briefly.
Yeah, so when the Germans first took France, they stopped before they'd conquered the entire country and allowed southern France to kind of create its own government called Vichy France. And this government was a puppet state to the Germans.
Yeah, collaborationist.
This is not a free and open and democratic France. These are people who the Germans just said, well, let's let them pretend to be French, but we're in charge. Now, because Vichy was allied with the Germans, they had information about the German war machine, particularly some of the codes and ciphers that the Germans were using to communicate. Because the Vichy embassy here in Washington, D.C. communicated back with not only Vichy France, but also with Berlin, they had copies of the code books that if we could get our hands on those, we had wide open access to a lot of the communications that the Germans were using to run the war. Well, they just so happened to be a couple blocks away from where I'm sitting right now in the Vichy embassy. And so Pack took it upon herself to find ways to infiltrate the Vichy embassy. And she used her wits and she used the fact that she was drop dead gorgeous in order to pull this off. And the story, she convinced someone who worked within the embassy, a Frenchman, to let her in and to help her basically through. So there are disagreements about whether she just basically sold him a bill of goods that she was in love with him or that she actually fell in love with him. There really is no way to know one way or the other. But she seduced him into helping the cause. And together they came up with this ruse where he would bring her to the embassy in the middle of the night. And knowing, you know, this is the French, right? The French love their romantic escapades.
Intrigue,
so the guards... Yeah, so the guards at the embassy would let her in and then go into a room and they lock the door and then they disrobe and pretend at the time that they were having kind of a sexual escapade, where at the same time they were running around trying to break into this safe. And they had a professional safe cracker that they let in the window who climbed up a ladder. And the safe cracker broke into the safe. I'm paraphrasing, I'm condensing the story a little bit for time. And they were able to secure the cipher codes. And, you know, one of the fun parts of the story was that they heard the guard coming. The guard got, you know, was doing his rounds and started walking up and got suspicious of the fact that kind of they were there and she might be working for the Allies, barged into their room, and they had enough time to basically strip and stand there in their birthday suit. The authorities got very, very embarrassed that they had broken in on this escapade because, again, talk about the romance of the French, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to get in the way of this young love.
Yeah, first things first.
Right, first things first. And so they said, oh, we're sorry, and backed out of the room the whole time that they're stealing these top secret cipher codes.
All right, we're getting down to kind of toward the end of the show here, Vince, but let's talk about one more agent. And this is much more modern times after World War II, June Cobb, a CIA agent in Cuba during the Cold War. Just kind of give us a thumbnail synopsis of her.
So June Cobb was a CIA contract worker, basically. She didn't go through all the same kind of training that people like Virginia Hall would have, or any modern CIA officer. What made her really interesting is that she was a close confidant of Fidel Castro. She worked with him prior to when he went full-fledged communist and reached out to the Soviets, but she was somewhat seduced by the idea of making Cuba independent, redistribution of wealth, a lot of the early ideas that the Castro Revolution had for it. Once he became more of a dictator than a revolutionary, and once he reached out to the Soviet Union, she agreed to work for CIA against Castro to bring in information to provide insight into what was happening inside Cuba. Now, the scuttlebutt, here's where we go more to, you know, again, to urban legend, a connection with Lee Harvey Oswald and the JFK assassination. It's likely when she would later work in Mexico, she did encounter Lee Harvey Oswald at a party and at least had the communication with him, perhaps a conversation, who knows, but later on was able to tell American intelligence and American law enforcement about Lee Harvey Oswald and the fact that he was in Mexico dealing with some of these high-level leftists who work for the Cuban government.
So there is this kind of mysterious connection between her and Oswald and the Mexican embassy and people there. Cubans and Mexicans as well, and it gets tied into the JFK murder conspiracies theories. So there's this big bubble of June Cobb in the middle of that. And I think I remember that material on her is going to be declassified toward the end of 2017.
Yeah, October. The reason I'm hedging on this one is because I don't want to say anything stupid that in a couple months is going to be completely refuted by the real evidence. So we're going to know a whole lot more very soon about, you know, what is real and what is urban legend.
So I think, actually, I remember that there was some speculation that she was one of Fidel Castro's many mistresses. He installed her as his PR assistant in an office right down the street. But just very briefly, do you think that's likely to be true?
It's perhaps. Again, I'm not going to impugn her reputation when I have no knowledge whatsoever about that. But Fidel had a way with women, certainly.
Sure.
And, you know, there are a lot of stories, and we won't get into them, but there are a lot of stories of him just seducing women left and right because of his charm and his charisma.
Yeah, and she was tall, again, tall and good-looking and American. So then we've talked about a bunch of women, and a couple of them we've talked about have used sex as a tool of their trade. And there's even a term for it I had never heard called sexpionage, kind of clever. So do you think that these were women who were doing it unwillingly, kind of gritting their teeth and just doing it as part of the job for God and country? Or did they, in some cases, just have, I think the Betty Pack had a natural proclivity for it that turned out to be useful?
Yeah, and I think it's impossible to stereotype, you know, all of them are the same. They were all forced into it or they all use it. I think Betty Pack gets a bad rap for who she was. It's probably likely she just fell in love a ton of times, you know, and she wasn't just being a kind of, you know, people have called her a nymphomaniac, which is ridiculous. I think she actually just kind of fell in love with a lot of guys and she realized how effectively this could be used to gather information. But where you look at people like Mata Hari and Betty Pak and others, that's the stereotype of women spies, but that's certainly not typical for women spies. And I think that's a problem. I think that actually modern pop culture and Bond is a great example of where the women tend to be kind of these sex pots or
glamorous,
have these
yeah.
ridiculous names, glamour. I mean, glamorous is fine, but the fact that all of them are using their bodies to gather information
right.
is not something that is true. And actually, it really does take away from the kind of work that women intelligence officers do today. And I think even modern pop culture falls in this trap, too, with shows like Homeland, where, yes, the lead character is brilliant. She's a great analyst. She's a very good case officer. But at the same time, she's constantly kind of sleeping her way around to get other information. And that is just not the way things happen. In fact, in the CIA, it's very much frowned upon. You're not supposed to use sex, whether you're a male or a female, in order to gather and collect information. And they don't have to. And this is where kind of the broader emphasis of my point is. It's because the vast majority, talking 99.9% of women working for CIA today, are smart enough to collect information using their wits and their capabilities and their charisma and the same thing that men are using today to gather information.
Vince, we're at the end of the show here, so it's been very interesting. But, I mean, clearly all of these people we've been talking about are very brave, very resourceful, some extremely so. And, you know, I think today human intelligence collection is more technological and less on the ground, you know, in a small room with an enemy kind of a thing most of the time, at least for CIA officers. But I'll tell you what, this has been so great, and a lot of our listeners might want to follow up on some of these people, and I hope they've kind of remembered some of the names, but what's the best source online or in books to learn about these heroic women?
So I want to warn the listeners that there's a lot of garbage out there, you know, kind of talking about rumors and urban legends. Incidentally, the CIA has an extraordinary website, extraordinary resources for this. The CIA Online Reading Room has a lot of well-curated and well-crafted essays on most of these women that we've talked about today, including many more that we didn't have time to deal with.
How do they get to that, Vince? Is it CIA.gov? Or
CIA.gov.
Okay, so another great one is spymuseum.org, which is your outfit.
Absolutely, yeah. So after or before you go to the CIA, come to spymuseum.org. You can check out some of these stories here. And we actually have a really great online bibliography of a lot of books that you can kind of tackle if you want to go even further into these stories.
Vince, we've got to leave it there. So thank you so much, Dr. Vincent Houghton, for being on with us from the International Spy Museum in Washington. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.